next weeks, we'll be able to fill in and so forth. I might say some things that are a revision, I guess. But the whole theme of this book, really, is, apart from the glory of God, isn't it good to have a God who's never had to say, oops? What a relief. How could God, a good God, allow suffering? Tim Keller, The Reason for God, I guess many of you have read this. I don't know if anyone read it in the previous weeks, have they? Tim Keller's got a large Presbyterian church in New York. My son is church planting there, and Tim Keller has been one of his mentors. So he's a great guy. And he talks at the beginning of each chapter of questions that people he's come across in New York, things that are troubling them. So this is one. How could a good God allow suffering? I just don't believe the God of Christianity exists, said Hillary, an English undergraduate. God allows terrible suffering in the world, so he might either be all-powerful but not good enough to end evil and suffering, or else he might be all-good but not powerful enough to end evil and suffering. Either way, the all-good, all-powerful God of the Bible couldn't exist. Many people feel like that. This isn't a philosophical issue for me, added Rob, Hillary's boyfriend. This is personal. I won't believe in a God who allows suffering, even if he, she, or it does exist. Maybe God exists, maybe not. But if he does, he can't be trusted. Many people think like that. And there are many approaches to this. I think it might be good if I got my Bible out. It's a problem. It's a problem for atheists too. How do you deal with some of these issues? Mind you, if an atheist, really, there's no such thing as good and evil. And what is, and of course, all this suffering and stuff is the way that the wonderful creation myth of evolution works. So we shouldn't complain about it. But it is a problem. Hindus have the problem solved. Isn't that good to know? It's all about the law of karma. And the Western way of saying that is what goes around comes around. And it's all about you paying in a previous life. So if you are having lots of suffering in this life, it's because in your last life you did a lot of bad things. And so you just know that I deserve what's happening to me. If you are very blessed in this life, if you're a Brahmin, you know that's because you were very, very good in your last life. And you deserve to be where you are at the top of the pile. And of course, you've got to keep your caste. So that's one way of solving this. That's Satan's way, I suggest. And even some Christians hint some sort of ideas along that line where if you're having a bad time, for instance, if you're not healed, it's your fault. I knew of a situation in Perth where a man had cancer, and he went to a big church and he was prayed for, and they said, well, you've been healed in the spirit, but you're not healed yet in the flesh. And he got worse, and they said, well, obviously you haven't got enough faith, so it's your fault. He got worse. Well, you've obviously got a lot of sin in your life, so you need to sort that out. He finally died. Do you know how many people from that church went to his funeral? Not a single solitary one. Just when he needed all the love and support and care, all he got was condemnation. Sadly, that sometimes happens. Well, Job is going through a terrible suffering. I just think after our children's talk, I don't need to say a whole lot actually, but anyway. And when you think of that, we can read that lightly, but just imagine what he's going through. And basically, Job says, it's not my fault. All his friends, he did have some, unlike that other person I was talking about, assured him that it probably was. So let's think about this. He's struggling. His friends are, as people said, if you've got friends like that, you don't need enemies. His friends are giving you all sorts of advice, and some of the things they say is very good, and you've looked at all those things. But then at last, God speaks. He cries out to God, and God speaks. Have you ever heard God speak to you vividly like that? Maybe not verbally. I was in a situation once, and it was pretty devastating. I seriously thought about riding my motorbike into an oncoming semi-trailer, and it was a serious thought. I thought, this is serious. And I was feeling utterly devastated. And God spoke to me vividly in my mind. And I don't care whether you believe that or not, because I know he did. And I was looking down a deep tunnel, and there was no light at the end of it. And when God spoke, a light switched on at the end of it. Have you experienced that? That's some of the deepest lessons I've ever learned, was through that experience. And God teaches us. We'll think about that just a minute. So anyway, chapter 1 of verse 38. We can't read all of it, I think, simply because it'll take too long, so we'll just have to do a little bit of skimming. And as we heard earlier, God speaks out of the storm. Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. He said, "Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me." And then he goes on with a whole lot of rhetorical questions. For instance, as we heard earlier, where were you when the earth's foundation was laid? He talks about the creation of the world and the way it's been structured. Where were you? Were you involved in that? Then he talks about the sea, 8 and 11, we had a little about that, about God's arrangement of the sea and organization of the sea and control of the sea in verses 8 to 11. Then in verses 12 to 30, it was about God's sovereign power over day and night and over the seasons and the weather. Asking Job these questions, where were you? Can you control that? Verses 31 to 33, about God's control of the heavens and the constellations. Can you do that? Then at 34 to 38, more about the weather. Then God turns to the created kingdom and he talks about lions. Do you feed the lions? He talks about ravens. Are you the one that feeds the ravens? And chapter 39, he moves on. He talks about mountain goats and discusses mountain goats and wild donkeys. And he talks about the ostrich. And he has quite a session on the horse. The horse is the only domesticated animal that he mentions there. And he uses hyperbole, exaggeration for effect. It's poetic. This whole thing is a sort of a poem. It's very graphic as you read it. Then he moves on to the hawk, and then he talks about the eagle. And God asks all these questions, and Job's saying, "No, no, 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 I don't, I can't, no." Absolutely overwhelmed. God just pointing out reality. And then in chapter 40, verse 1, the Lord said to Job, "Will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Are you trying to tell me what to do, Job? You don't seem to be able to do all these things, and you want to tell me what to do? Let him who accuses God answer him." Then Job answered the Lord, "I'm unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I'll say no more." Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm again. Job's getting the message. Who are you to criticize my justice? And God says, "Brace yourself like a man. I will question you. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Are you saying that I'm wrong so that you look right? Is that what you are trying to do with Almighty God?" And then the Lord goes on and says to him, I'll put it in my words. He basically says, if you have my attributes, if you can do what I can do, then maybe you have the right to be able to judge and to discuss justice. Do you have an arm like mine? Does your voice thunder like mine? Do you have my glory, my splendor, my honor, and my majesty? Can you unleash the fury of your wrath and deal with every proud man and bring him down? Can you crush and destroy the wicked? And God says, well, if you can do that, I guess you don't need me. You can talk about justice. Obviously, Job had none of those things. And we move on to two other interesting animals in chapter 40, verses 15 to 24. For example, look at the behemoth. Now, there's been various thoughts about what the behemoth is. One of the things it talks about the behemoth, his tail sways like a cedar, and somebody suggested that the behemoth might be a hippopotamus. If you've seen a hippopotamus, it might be a cedar, but it's a very, 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 very small sapling of a cedar. So I think it's probably not a hippopotamus. It's been suggested that maybe when he's talking about the tail, possibly it's the trunk of the elephant. Certainly elephants are very impressive. Creation ministries say this is a very good picture, really, a description of a particular type of dinosaur. And they have found images and paintings and carvings of dinosaurs and temples and on rock art, which they obviously must have got from Google. But so who knows what it was, but it is very, very impressive. He told no one is fierce enough. No, I'm looking at behemoth still. Before we get on to Leviathan. And he describes the strength of this animal, this creature, its enormous strength, its power. His bones and tubes are tubes of bronze, his limbs like rods of iron. He ranks first amongst the works of God, yet his maker can approach him with his sword. The hills bring him their produce. So it's a poetic picture of this amazing, incredible, impressive animal. And then at the end he says, can anyone capture him by the eye or trap him or pierce his nose? Can you get and control this animal? And basically the answer was, no, you can't. Another one of God's great, impressive creations. And then we move on to Leviathan. Can you pull in the Leviathan with a fish hook? And here again we have hyperbole. He talks about this animal. It's got scales and is impenetrable and tremendously fierce. And he talks about fire coming from its mouth and things like this. So it's poetry for effect. People think from the description, he talks about all sorts of things of it. The folds of his flesh are tightly joined. They are firm and immovable. The chest is hard as a rock, hard as a lower millstone. When he rises up, the mighty are terrified. They retreat before his threshing. He says, if you try and touch this, you'll remember it all your life. You'll never do it again. And so people consider probably this is talking about a saltwater crocodile. And maybe the Nile crocodile, huge animals. I read an account some years ago in a magazine that was talking about in the early days of the colony here in Australia, and it mentioned that there was a crocodile that had been caught, and it was, I think it was 29 feet long. Just think about that. So certainly a crocodile is very, very impressive. And then he goes on at the end of the chapter. Behold him, he leaves a glistening wake. One would think the deep had white hair. Nothing on earth is his equal, a creature without fear. He looks down on all that are haughty. Then Job replied to the Lord at all this. He says, I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now, and I will speak. I will question you, and you shall answer me. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. And then we move on to the end, which will be looked at next week. He's totally overwhelmed. He has learned his place. He basically says, this is just far too, I can't understand these things. I have no idea about them. How much less do I understand your justice? And so he moves on. I spoke in ignorance. A few thoughts about this, some final thoughts on this. We could go through the poetry. It's very impressive and descriptive. And basically it's showing God's incredible majesty and power. I think it's interesting that God graciously speaks to Job in wonders of creation that he knew and could understand. So he speaks about the animals and the creatures and the things that Job knew about the earth, about its the power of storms and sea and the way it's established. And Job could understand that. He was overwhelmed at the majesty and amazing aspects of it all. But today we know so much more of the incredible wonder of creation than Job knew. 100 billion cells in the human brain. And I read somewhere that each one has got 1,000 synapses joining with the others. That human brain is an absolutely mysterious, incredible thing. Some time ago, a neurologist, forgot his name now, as the Boyer lectures, he said that neurologists working with the human brain is a little bit like trying to work on a Swiss watch with a pick. That's a little bit what it's like. The mystery of it is just absolutely phenomenal. And to think that we can make a human brain, you know, goodness me. It's recognised, like someone said, it's the most complicated, incredible thing in known creation. The incredible complexity of the DNA genetic code is like an encyclopedia existing in a microscopic little cell. I read somewhere recently that if you stretched it out, it would be almost 2 metres long, all wrapped up, twirled up inside this miniature cell. Incredibly complicated. And the information is like an encyclopedia in that. Other amazing facts about the human body. The fact that if you had all the arteries and veins of the human blood circulatory system and you put them end to end, it would be 100,000 kilometres long in one human body. Some of the arteries and some of the veins are so small that blood cells go through them one at a time. The incredible miniature complexity in these bodies of ours, let alone the rest of creation. On the other extreme, God mentions astronomy to Job and talks about the constellations. In 1923, the astronomer Edwin Hubble discovered something dramatically new about the universe. Up to that time, apparently, the universe was considered to be, the total was the Milky Way, the galaxy that we live in. And the little misty spots that you could see were actually part of our galaxy, our home galaxy. And Edwin Hubble, I think, was using the Palomar telescope, discovered as late as 1923 that actually the Milky Way was just one of a huge number of galaxies, and these little misty patches were not actually in the Milky Way at all. They were huge galaxies. There's one galaxy near us, well, near, a neighbour of ours in space, the Andromeda Galaxy, which is twice as big across as the Milky Way. And to give you a bit of an idea of the size of the Milky Way, if our whole solar system was the size of the rim of a coffee cup, I've even heard it mentioned as a 10-cent coin, but let's think of the coffee cup. The sun in the middle and all the planets, the extent of the orbits of all those planets, on that scale, the Milky Way would be the size of Australia. Think about that. Our solar system in a galaxy the size of Australia. Absolutely incredible. And so that's new. The Hubble telescope, named after Mr. Edwin Hubble, is able to take some amazing photographs. I've got some here. I won't show them because you can look at them afterwards. Amazing photographs. I guess you've seen a lot of them. And it was focusing its very sensitive camera on an area of the sky the size of a grain of sand at arm's length. Now, just think about that. Size of a grain of sand at arm's length, an empty part of the sky, just a black part of the sky. It focused on that tiny little bit of the sky for 10 days, and there were 1,500 galaxies there in that part of the sky. The size and complexity of this universe that we just recently have come to understand. They say that probably there's at least 100 billion galaxies in the universe. The idea of a billion is hard to understand. If you look at your nail, maybe, you know, a millimetre is about, say, the size of twice your nail. A billion is how many of those little guys in 1,000 kilometres? No. I think I've underestimated it. Yes, I think it's 1,000 kilometres. Yeah, 1,000 kilometres. You think about that. So we're talking enormous numbers, the vastness and the hugeness of it all. And we read in Isaiah 55, verse 8 and 9, and only now, much more than Job, it says, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declare the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, just think about that one, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. We are dealing with a God of infinite majesty, infinite power, infinite glory. Just a few more things before we close. It would seem that Job knew the reason. Sorry, that's. It seemed that Job never knew the reason for his suffering. But God certainly did have his reasons. Job didn't know, but God had reasons. And I just suggest that when we do go through this, there are reasons for it. God has his reasons. And in Isaiah 50, verse 10, it says, who among you that fears the Lord, that obeys the voice of his servant, that walks in darkness and has no light? That's talking about somebody who is serving the Lord and loves him, but he doesn't know what's going on. Everything is dark. Let him trust in the name of the Lord and rely on his God. And that was God's message to Job. Just trust me, Job. I've got it in hand. I know what I'm doing. I'm big enough and powerful enough to have all this stuff under control. You don't have to worry. I've got it in hand. John Dixon recently spoke at the university, I think it was a couple of years ago, as to why the Bible was the best seller in the year. And it was, if you were there, he said it was the best seller every year and has been the best seller, except for, I think it was 2008, when Harry Potter and the Deadly Hallows beat it. Just that year. But every year, every second, the Bible is sold around the world. It's the best seller in China. And he said he felt there were four reasons for that. One was it explains the beauty of the world, explains the beauty of the cosmos. Secondly, it explains the ugliness. It speaks about a resolution at the end when everything will be resolved and justice will be done and all will be well. And lastly, it speaks about how God is involved. He suggested that if you were offered the choice of two bits of knowledge, if you were going through suffering, is to know exactly why, the reason for that, or the knowledge that at the end it would all be resolved and would all justice would be done and everything would be worked out. He suggested probably you'd want to know the second one. I think that's probably right. And the bit about God being involved, God's not up there watching us squirm. He knows more about suffering than any human will ever know, I believe. What he went through, we hear of people who are being burnt at the stake, who die singing hymns and dying gloriously, but we find the Son of God crying out, my God, why have you deserted me? It's almost as if the Trinity was ripped apart at that time. And that's a suffering that we will never ever experience. God knows more about suffering, far infinitely more than any suffering, physical suffering. And crucifixion was a death by torture. So he knows all about suffering. He's been there. He understands. He's not outside. He's not theory to him. He's experienced it. And that's a great comfort for us. And a few other things, just briefly. I think the Psalm 147, verse 3 and 4, is a thumbnail sketch of the character of God. He heals the brokenhearted and binds up their wounds. He counts the number of the stars and gives names to them all. That's God. When you're hurting, he cares about you and he can comfort you while he is controlling 100 billion galaxies at the same time. That's what God's like. Psalm 34, the Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. He is near to the brokenhearted. If any of you are brokenhearted, God is near you. One of the names of the Holy Spirit is the Comforter. That's a nice doctrine to hold, but it's a very different thing when you experience his comfort. That's a different thing altogether, when you experience the comfort of the Holy Spirit as you go through things. Revelation 7, verse 17, God will wipe every tear from their eyes. Revelation 21, verse 4, he shall wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. There will be a resolution. All will be infinitely well. Paul, who went through a great deal of suffering, I think he had the 39 lashes five times. That was quite often fatal. He was beaten with rods, I think it was three times. Could you imagine the job of the chiropractor if you'd been beaten with rods? Plus a whole lot of other things. Paul says, for momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. And Paul knew about suffering. Even Jesus went through what he went through for the joy before him, because he was purchasing his bride. And the joy of that. So, you often learn your best lessons through difficulties. I found that. That experience I had, I learned, I think, the deepest spiritual lesson I've ever learned. And when everything goes well, you tend not to. That's wonderful. You can enjoy the presence of the Lord. But when you go through heavy times, there are lessons there that you will learn that you cannot learn in any other way. And that's one of the things the Lord said to me. He said, through this, I'm going to teach you lessons that you couldn't learn in any other way. And that actually made sense to me. That was the light switched on in the tunnel. So 1 Peter talks us being refined. Hebrews 12 talks about us being disciplined by God. So it's got to, the character we have is what we take to heaven. And character just doesn't happen overnight. It's got to be developed. And God's doing that. And we've got time. A man by the name of Dave Reaver. I'll just tell you his story. He was in the Vietnam War. A phosphorus, I think, grenade exploded in his face, and he lost a lot of his face, one of his eyes and his ear and so forth. He was absolutely devastated and cried out to God like Job and finally said, well, Lord, I just have to serve you the way I am. When he was there in medical school, he was a Christian. He said, all I had was God and he was enough. He spoke to the high schools. He used to joke. He said, I play the piano by ear. So you take his ear off and he'd play the piano. And they're all sitting on the edge of their seat listening to this man and God greatly using him. God has a way of using tragedy for his glory. And he specialises in that. And just finally, two questions to ask God if you're going through stuff like this. Lord, what do you want me to learn? What do you want me to do? And his basic message is, trust me, I know what I'm doing, and I love you. Romans 8, nothing can separate us from his love ever.